Greetings, listeners. This is Ralph Edwards, a.k.a. Warren, from the Concrete Gang and Creatures of the Industry podcast. I feel privileged to introduce the Concrete Gang 50th Anniversary Archive, because this is the 50th anniversary of the Concrete Gang on Community Radio 3CR, first started by the rank and file of the BLF, and now presented by the rank and file of the CFMEU. We've been presenting a weekly program about our industry and the struggles it's faced over those 50 years. In fact, since 3CR first went to air in February 1976. This archive comes in two parts. First, the good old days, inverted commas, when it was recorded on reel-to-reel and then recorded over. So, special thanks to our loyal listeners who have recorded them on their cassette tape recorders as they listened on a Sunday morning, and save them for everyone to enjoy again. Second part of the archive is when we entered the 21st century in the early 2000s and the show was digitally recorded and kept as we went. So the material, although patchy in its continuity, shows the transition of the Concrete Gang over 50 years, in those two parts of approximately 25 years each. So enjoy the listen, and thanks to all those who presented the program and all those who helped get it to air. You will find it on www.3cr.org.au/Concrete Gang 50 Years, all one word. Dare to struggle, dare to win.
We're putting up new buildings, we're knocking down the old. We're working in the summer heat and in the winter cold. And the labour power we sell, me boys, for a hard-earned weekly pay produces mighty profits for the greedy MBA. So keep your powder dry and hold your head up high. It's class to class and face to face, our limit is the sky. We've got a fighting history and we never will be cowed. A builder's labourer is a name to make a man feel proud. And whether we were born here or born in Italy, in Greece or Spain or Ireland, in England or Fiji, we all of us are workers, and united we must stand until the wealthy bludgers have been driven from our land. So keep your powder dry and hold your head up high. It's class to class and face to face, our limit is the sky. We've got a fighting history and we never will be cowed. A builder's labourer is a name to make a man feel proud. We faced deregistration and it backfired in their face. We're not fooled by arbitration and we won't stay in our place. We hit the bosses hard and fast to win and keep our gains and break a couple of concrete pours to back our log of claims. So keep your powder dry and hold your head up high. It's class to class and face to face, our limit is the sky. We've got a fighting history and we never will be cowed. A builder's labourer is a name to make a man feel proud. Yes, keep your powder dry and hold your head up high. It's class to class and face to face, our limit is the sky. We've got a fighting history and we never will be cowed. A builder's labourer is a name to make a man feel proud.
Good evening once again. Tonight our major item concerns the re-registration of the Builders Labourers Federation and questions raised by this. We also have a couple of tapes by two intrepid defenders of Australian independence, Peacock and Kerr, as well as an opinion of ours on the IAC. So without any further ado, let her rip. Bruce, I think it is, isn't it? You got the... Oh, sorry, Joe.
Oh, that's all right. I'll let you off this time. Now, well, the first thing, we're very pleased to say that we've got another letter, which has been sent to us, this time by a couple in Elwood. Extracts of the letter read: May I express my congratulations and best wishes for the future of your program. The Builders Labourers Show is extremely thought-provoking and interesting. I was particularly pleased to hear you speak out against USSR imperialism, as well as against capitalist exploitation. And the letter goes on to say, my only concern is that under the rumoured new media controlling body, such stations as 3CR with its radical items could be prevented from investigating aspects of government administration. That's really good to hear, isn't it, Keith?
My word, Joe. Right, now, Bruce, you can let her rip.
On the 7th of December, the small country of East Timor, which lies just 600 kilometres to the northwest of Darwin, was invaded by Indonesian forces. However, the Timorese people put up widespread resistance in defence of their independence. And as a result, within months, the Indonesians had slaughtered more than 10% of the entire population of the country. Nevertheless, in spite of this ruthless oppression, the Timorese have refused to give in. They know of the 100,000 political prisoners in Indonesia and of the bloody origins of the Suharto regime. And they're not prepared to have their first chance of freedom in 400 years snatched from them in this way. Since December the 7th, well-armed guerrilla forces led by Fretilin, the Timorese nationalist group, have held off the Indonesian forces and inflicted heavy casualties on them. And thus, despite repeated attacks, the invading army has been unable to gain control of more than about a quarter of the land area of the country. The Timorese have shown that they're capable of conducting their own armed struggle, but their ultimate success depends also on international pressure on Indonesia from foreign governments. It's in this context that the visit of Malcolm Fraser to Indonesia this week was of importance. The policy that he had said his government was following on East Timor demanded immediate withdrawal of Indonesian forces and self-determination for the Timorese people. However, this week it emerged that in his talks with President Suharto, Fraser had secretly reversed this policy and assured the Indonesians that Australia would no longer pursue its objections to an Indonesian takeover of the island. But although this reversal is obvious, the government refuses to admit what it has done for fear of the public outcry in Australia that's sure to result. The following interview with the Minister for Foreign Affairs, Andrew Peacock, illustrates the duplicity of the Fraser government, as well as its characteristic deviousness and dishonesty. It's replayed from the ABC News. A reporter had asked Mr. Peacock whether Australia still favoured an Indonesian withdrawal and self-determination for East Timor.
The position remains as I've indicated in the past on Timor, and
well, that was indicated. So it's very simple.
Well, it's been simply stated in the communique, as you saw.
But we set out now.
No, I've set out the policy on so many occasions, there's no need to restate it now, as we've indicated during the period we were in Jakarta.
So we are still given to a satisfactory free choice and a withdrawal from East Timor, are
we? Our policy is enunciated within the communique. It deals with our relations with Indonesia in the totality. It covers the development of close ties with the ASEAN countries. It develops the attitude, particularly on the Indian Ocean, which is similar to... Are we going this way?
But what about withdrawal and free choice, sir?
Well, you know the elements of the policy that I've stated time and again. Anybody else got some questions?
We apologise for the quality of that tape, but the fault lies not with the Concrete Gang, but with the ABC. In contrast to Mr. Peacock's apparent confusion, a few people we interviewed, more or less at random, didn't have any doubts about the real nature of the government's apparently inconsistent policy.
Well, there's been a lot of fiddle-faddling around and playing with words, but the guts of the whole thing is that the Fraser government's just towed the US line and have supported the Indonesian generals in their invasion of Timor.
It's been, well, consistent. Medibank, they had a policy. They operated differently. Indexation, they had a policy. They did something different. Timor, they've got a policy, and now they've done something different.
The Fraser government has betrayed the Timorese people.
Yes, well, it's pretty clear that there's a lot of difference in opinion there between the Minister of Foreign Affairs and the ordinary Australian people.
Yeah, you listen to that, you wouldn't think he had an opinion.
Yeah, that's right. That's the point, isn't it? Well, a few days ago, at some dinner or other that he was addressing, our intrepid Governor-General pessimistically predicted that we're going to be stuck with the monarchy in Australia, and although he didn't say it, he might have meant himself too, for maybe another 100 years. Oh, think of that, yeah. Well, since we're on the subject of quoting reactionaries, here's how he continued.
The fact of the matter is that throughout the length and breadth of Australia, where the monarchy of Her Majesty is unanimously recognised, except for a few marginal people who... who really, I think, know little about what they are doing.
Right, well, for all you marginal people out there in 3CR land who really don't know what you're doing, enough of that, and now we'll get on to some good stuff. We've got a poem coming up now, and I'll just give you a bit of an intro to it before we hear it from Keith. In July 1939, the Menzies government tried to introduce a national register in Australia. Workers throughout Australia, knowing well that Menzies, like Chamberlain in Britain, aimed primarily at repression of the workers, rightly opposed the register. At Port Kembla, where Wharfies shortly before had gone on strike rather than load the Delfram with scrap iron for Japan, the workers publicly burned their register cards and took the oath of Eureka. We swear by the Southern Cross to stand truly by each other and fight to defend our rights and liberties. The register was, in fact, a fiasco. The following poem was written in July 1939 by Bartlett Adamson.
The workers of Kembla, those leaders of men, those leaders indeed as in thought, they challenged the might of the pound and the yen, and there, at the Delfram they fought, the cause of the Chinese distraught. And still marching onward, with gaze lifted sunward, the call of Eureka is caught. Democracy thrills to the message of yore, the vow of Eureka has echoed once more. The workers awaken, they rally and rise. The workers have taken the lead. With light of Eureka aflame in their eyes, united in word and in deed, they fight the conscriptionist creed. No despot shall darken our wide land for hearken. These men of the Southern Cross breed, they raise the bright flag that all true men adore. They march in the light of Eureka once more. Eureka the flag, by that symbol they swear, unswerving to stand to the fight. And sworn to the faith of Eureka they dare to march in their militant might, to battle for freedom and right, to vanquish each traitor, each fascist dictator, each monster of death and of night. The workers now march like those freemen of yore, they take the firm oath of Eureka once more. The workers have trampled the councils of doom, of cowardly leaders that quake. This register card is a ticket of doom, then spurn it and burn it and break each move that the tyrannies make. The workers have risen, and heedless of prison, and bidding democracy wake, they march man to man, with those great men of yore, they swear the great vow of Eureka once more. That mistake, by the way, was because I was a marginal person and I didn't know what I was doing. I'm sorry.
I'm glad to hear that, Keith, aren't we all? Right, Bruce, you've got the next segment, mate.
You're listening to the 50-year anniversary archive of the Concrete Gang. Unbelievable that we're still going. So listen on.
You're listening to 3CR Community Radio. This is the Concrete Gang. The time is 12 minutes past 6. Our next segment is about trade unions and how in this society they are at times forced, because of their very nature, to work against the interests of the workers they are supposed to represent. We examine as a case study the recent history of our own union, the BLF. We hope that the following discussion will provoke controversy and debate among workers in general about the nature of trade unionism and about possible alternative organisations that workers could create.
A few weeks ago, we had something to say about the Victorian building industry lockout of 1975. This week, we intend to go into the lessons of that lockout and what this means to builders' labourers right now. In June 1975, the Master Builders Association of Victoria locked out all building workers in the metropolitan area. The economic crisis was hitting their profits, and they decided the time had come to smash job site militancy. In a letter sent to employees when the lockout was 2 weeks old, R.G. Gardner, general manager of E.A. Watts, had this to say.
We told the unions that in their interests as well as ours, these stoppages, etc., would have to stop, and that if they wanted more wages and conditions for their members, they should do things through the right channels, not impose bans, stop concrete pours, and all those actions that cost builders and clients money.
After 8 weeks, all unions except the Builders Labourers Federation capitulated. They signed a one-way document which promised to accept the decision of the arbitration court on all outstanding disputes and to lift all bans and not impose new ones. What the building unions had done, in actual fact, was to sign away their members' right to strike in exchange for a paid picnic day. The Builders Labourers, however, refused to sign such a surrender. A mass meeting at Dallas Brooks Hall decided overwhelmingly to impose guerrilla bans on the bosses and to force them to negotiate. The meeting decided that all crane crews would work only 8 hours per day instead of the usual practice of having the hook on the ground by 7:30 a.m. and working through smoko and lunchtime when needed.
This sent the bosses crazy because it meant they were losing thousands of dollars in production. Their immediate reaction was to ban weekend work, but they soon realised their blunder as a confidential document of the National Industrial Executive of the Master Builders admitted.
In view of its ineffectiveness on the employees and the pressure being put on members by their clients, it is suggested that the ban on weekend overtime be lifted. Indeed, if the 40-hour ban is having any effect, it is probably only emphasising to employees that in periods when overtime is not available, their wages are inadequate in their eyes, and is assisting Mr. Gallagher in his campaign to gain an extra $10 per week.
This document, dated September the 17th, 1975, decided on another and far more devious plan of attack.
The Association's industrial officers recommend that the following be considered as the third alternative, that is, to take provocative action to force the union to widen the dispute itself and receive in the eyes of the public and other workers the blame for the current critical situation. A, that all members with cranes on site should on the same day ask a crane crew if they are prepared to work through lunchtime. If the crew, as can be expected, refuses, they should be dismissed for misconduct in failing to abide by a lawful direction from an employer. The union's reaction to this could be fourfold. One, they could simply direct the crew to accept dismissal and continue the bans with the remaining crew members. If this occurs, it is suggested that the action be repeated in approximately 2 days. Two, they could direct their members to accept dismissal but declare his crane black. If this occurs, it is also suggested that the action be repeated in 2 days. Three, they could direct the crew to refuse dismissal and continue working. If this occurs, it is recommended that after fair warning the crew be removed, where practicable, or alternatively be charged with trespassing as they leave the site at the completion of work. Four, the first dismissal above or subsequent dismissals could provoke the union or the crane crews into spontaneously taking strike action. This would result in the widening of the dispute at the union's behest, and if it continued for any period of time, other employees would be stood down with the Builders Labourers Federation clearly to blame.
This little plot came unstuck because the union managed to get hold of the document and published it in the daily press through paid advertisements. So far, the master builders had failed to find a way to bring the Builders Labourers Union to heel, but something was brewing over the border which made the bosses' task easier. At the behest of the Soviet imperialists, Pat Clancy's Building Workers Industrial Union launched an attack on builders' labourers in Canberra. Taking advantage of the fact that the Builders Labourers Federation was deregistered from the arbitration system, the Building Workers Industrial Union tried to take over the ACT branch of the Builders Labourers Federation. Clancy next intended to move into Queensland and then the other states. The master builders saw the perfect opportunity to sink the boots into the builders' labourers. A number of companies declared they would only employ builders' labourers with BWIU tickets. The BWIU put forward an application to vary its award so it could cover builders' labourers. In nearly every state except Victoria, the BLF leadership considered they could not withstand Clancy's attack while they remained deregistered. The Builders Labourers Federal Management Committee decided that the union must become re-registered at all costs. They were at the mercy of the master builders, and the bosses extracted a heavy price. In order to preserve itself, the union signed a document of surrender to the Master Builders Association. The introduction to this document shows the class collaborationist nature of the deal.
It is anticipated that the signing of this document will introduce a new understanding in the area of industrial relations between the employers and the union, which ultimately will be of benefit to all associated with the industry.
After that sickening load of rubbish, the document gets down to the nitty-gritty.
Wage claim. The union will not pursue its claim for a $10 per week increase. Work bans. The union agrees to lift all work bans and limitations in all states. Lofty cranes. All members of the union are prepared to return to the position that existed prior to the current dispute of bans and limitations in Victoria. For example, it is agreed that there will be no disruption to the availability of crane crews to do work as required, including the hook to be on the ground at commencement time of work or shift on any site as and when required, and reasonable overtime which may include early starts or late finishes to enable completion of long operations or at vital stages of the work. Dispute settlement procedure. The union is prepared to accept the dispute settlement procedure when established as part of the National Trades Construction Award. Such disputes settlement procedure to provide that in the event of disputes there will be no withdrawal or restriction of labour prior to the initial hearing before the appropriate tribunal.
In return for this, the Master Builders Association promised to only recognise the Builders Labourers Federation as the union covering builders labourers and not oppose the re-registration of the union. But they were very careful to keep a stick over the union's head.
In the event that a true spirit of cooperation is not forthcoming between the parties, the MBAs would press their opposition to the application for registration.
The Builders Labourers Federation has now been re-registered and the Building Workers Industrial Union attack has been defeated. But the union has been effectively castrated. It has virtually lost the right to strike, has accepted the wage freeze, and has forsaken its famous guerrilla tactics. If there's one thing this shows, it's the weakness of trade unions. In times of economic crisis, they are vulnerable to all sorts of attacks designed to make them do a job for the boss. It seems to us that job site action has more chance of beating the boss if it happens independent of union structures and union leaderships. They can deregister a union, but they can't deregister or jail or kill the whole working class.
It is strike time in the dear old Lithgow Valley. The men on strike intend to do their best.
A few scabs round the tyrants seem to rally, but there's not a spark of manhood in their
breasts.
When the tyrant said he'd take them down for tuppence, like a spirit each man seemed to disappear. As they said farewell, they added, we'll return again when you give that tuppence back, Charlie dear. When you give that tuppence back, Charlie dear, we can then return to work with conscience clear. But as heaven's sky is blue, we will never work for you till you give that tuppence back, Charlie dear. As we wander up and down old Lithgow Valley, the scenes of strife and want must give us pain. Standing for their rights like men of honour, let us hope the struggle will not be in vain. Then we wander down the roadway to the furnace, and it makes us sad to see scabs working there. They'd be better in the churchyard safely sleeping instead of being scabs for Charlie dear. When you give that tuppence back, Charlie dear, we can then return to work with conscience clear. But as heaven's sky is blue, we will never work for you till you give that tuppence back, Charlie dear.
That was When We Get Our Tuppence Back, and it's on a record called Man of the Earth, Songs and Ballads of the Australian Mining Industry, sung by Warren Fay and others. And just a little bit on the background of the song, the cover notes tell us that it was written in 1911, when Hoskins Mine in the Lithgow Valley took national headlines when the owner, Charles Hoskins, moved to reduce the miners' wages by tuppence a tonne in reply to their request for an increase of tuppence. In August, there occurred what became known as the Lithgow Riots. Pickets had adopted the practice of surrounding the blast furnace, accompanied by a brass band which played the Dead March. There was no serious trouble until the scabs, emboldened by their success in keeping Hoskins' fires going, climbed to the top of the hill and began to dance to the music. Incensed by this show of arrogance, the unionists stormed the mine and took control of the mine. The scabs took refuge in the engine room with Charles Hoskins. Conferences in the engine room proved unsuccessful, so the crowd grabbed the worldly possessions of the scabs and burnt them along with Mr. Hoskins' new Ford car.
About a week ago, the Industries Assistance Commission, in a report to the federal government, called for major changes in government aid to the performing arts. The Industries Assistance Commission, or IAC, is a body that was set up by the Whitlam government to coordinate government aid to industries which, as they put it, are experiencing temporary operating difficulties. Translated into somewhat blunter language, this means that it's a device by which the working people are made to subsidise directly, through their taxes, the workings of industries affected by the cyclical crises of capitalism. What has such a body got to do with art? Well, it seems that the government regards culture as an industry, like any other, which, to be allowed to continue to exist, must make a profit. And accordingly, the gist of the IAC report is just that government support should be withheld from those arts which cannot be proved to be economically viable. For according to them, if an art form is not profitable, then it must have lost its so-called contemporary relevance. In the rest of its report, the Commission called for greater efforts to be made to educate people about the arts and to make them more available to more people, something which they say would mean a democratisation of the performing arts in Australia. Now, we think that this report raises deep questions about the nature of capitalist society and the way in which it identifies artistic values with monetary ones, about the nature of art and culture in general, and about the possibilities for the development of a revolutionary culture in Australia. To initiate a possible continuing discussion of these issues on our program, yesterday I asked Doug White of La Trobe University for his comments on the report.
What seems to lie behind the Industries Assistance Commission report is that they regard the arts and culture generally as some kind of entertainment which should have an economic viability. In one sense, that's quite legitimate, that people should pay for their art. But if art, on the other hand, or culture in general, tells us something about the way society and culture, or the way everyday life operates, and proposes different ways of thinking about those things, it contradicts the main driver of that society. The main driver of that society is to measure things by their monetary value, and therefore culture couldn't be critical of that if it's measured in the same way. So it would seem that culture shouldn't be treated as a kind of industry, shouldn't be treated merely as an economic entertainment, a paying entertainment, but if it's going to be truly cultural, it can't be treated in those sort of forms. The proposal seems to me to want to abolish culture.
What do you mean by culture?
What I mean by culture is that it's a way of living and acting and thinking about the world which is not bound up with the ordinary ways of doing those sorts of things, or the obvious ways of doing those sorts of things. It brings out a hidden reality in our society, and it proposes different ways of living and acting and relating to one another. Therefore, culture has to always be, in some sense, in opposition to society.
But do the things that we commonly think of as culture, ballet, opera, symphony, concerts and so on, really stand in opposition to the society in this way?
Well, I think in a certain sense they do. Nevertheless, those particular examples of culture shouldn't be taken to mean all of culture. In some cases, those things provide a kind of a gloss for people who are generally fairly well off and benefiting from society to see things other than the way they're living by it. I think it's possible to think of culture as having a more democratic or popular meaning when the hopes and aspirations of the ordinary people are both reflected and made by culture. The arts, entertainment, or rather the arts, music and so on, which will bring out the elements of people's lives in a way that they can remake those lives.
So you're saying that our culture should be democratised. The Industries Assistance Commission also called for democratisation of the arts, didn't it?
Yes, that does seem to have two possible meanings, though. If they mean by democratisation that more people will buy it, they mean by democratisation the ordinary means of exchange in capitalist society. I think another way of looking at democratisation is something in the way the Builders' Labourers' Organisation has looked at it. That is, that the hopes and aspirations of the working people, expressed in art and song, should be made more available. That has required really a subsidy by the workers' organisation to bring that culture out into the open and to make it something that has more meaning in everyday life.
Well, how is such a revolutionary art and culture going to develop? Should we struggle, for example, for increased government support?
I think there's nothing wrong with government support, providing it's handled correctly. Government support really means, in one meaning of the term anyway, that we ask for our taxation money to be used for culture for the people. Now, it's always difficult to expect that the state will support things unless there's a struggle going on. In that case, it's the people's struggle that produces the money rather than the government that hands it over. The other way to do it, which is perhaps more direct and in a sense better, is for people's organisations to sponsor this other kind of culture or this kind of culture directly, as the builders' labourers have done.
Recently, government ministers and employer organisations have taken to calling for a greater orientation of education to vocation. Do you see any relationship between this tendency and the IAC report on the arts?
Yes, I think there's a great deal of similarity. Education is itself a cultural activity. On the other hand, it has got a relationship to production quite directly. I think when the government ministers call for education to be more closely related to industry, what they mean is that it should be directly related to the authority relations of industry. That is, they want young people to be more subordinate to employers, to place their skill at the service of others. Now, we can imagine an education which is more closely tied with production, with the social relations of production, so that people who take part in work experience or those other activities of that kind that might be associated with education learn something of those, of the way production is organised, the way the class struggle occurs in industry, and that to enlarge upon those things through the other aspects of schooling, where they learn something of the historical character of class struggle, something about the scientific nature of production, the relationships between people in production, they will, while it will be an education which is associated with production, it will be one which will be in opposition to the current property relations of production, that is to the ownership and control of production. I think the ministers who talk in this way are really saying that they want the authority relations reproduced, not understanding produced. Education should be about understanding, not about subordination.
Right, well, next week we'll present to you a little known aspect of the Soviet Union, and that aspect is piecework subcontracting in the Moscow housing industry.
And should be of interest to builders' labourers.
Yes,
sure.
It'll be good to see how the Moscow authorities try to pirouette around that little question.
Also, if anyone, I make my weekly call for anyone who has any comments, criticisms or suggestions of any of the material presented on our program, to contact us either via 3CR, the address is PO Box 145 Northcote 3070, through the Union Office, or since we'll be around for a few minutes after the program, you can ring us directly at 509-3160 tonight.
And now we're finishing up on a track from the Bushwhackers, and that's the theme from Ben Hall. So see you later, folks.
This is 3CR Community Radio. The time is 27 minutes to 7.
Thank you for listening to the Concrete Gang 50-year anniversary archive. All those episodes where we dared to struggle and we dared to win. And hopefully you've enjoyed it and come back and listen to some more. You will find it on www.3cr.org.au/Concrete Gang 50 years. Thank you very much.